What would you do if one day one of your lifelong friends came up to you and said, "Listen, buddy, I just do not want to be friends with you anymore because I find you too dull and I feel like I'm wasting my life talking to you. So the next time you talk to me, I will cut off one of my fingers and give them to you." What would you say to that? What would you think? How would you feel? Anyway, that was the summary of the movie. We can all go home now. This is the end of the episode. Bye. Hello, everyone. It's me, Grace Curley. I'm back. It's been a minute. Long time no see. So today, I will be reviewing and analyzing the 2022 film The Banshees of Inisherin, directed and written by Martin McDonagh. And I'm pretty sure this is a black comedy, as the kids say. So I hope you enjoy this episode. Stay tuned. The Banshees of Inisherin is the breath we have always been holding. It is the spike of terror as our souls slip on the crumbling ledge and we watch the pebbles tumble slowly into the turbulence. Naked in the dark, we are faced with human nature. And in the silence, we hear our heartbeats like drums counting our demise. Inside of us, there are two wolves, and one is striving to forsake its brother. One wolf is from the dust and bone of man's mammalian inception. Porik is the salt of the earth, unpossessed as the animals he shepherds. He is instinctive, sincere, capable in equal extremes of kindness and barbarism. In this way, the hare cannot know itself any longer than it needs to hop from one burrow to another. He is as reliable as the wheat that makes the bread, yet man cannot live off bread alone. The other wolf has grown from the same seed yet leapt from the henge. Illumination has woken Colum to the wastefulness of time. The mundane has filled his mind with the clang of refuse and distraction and can no longer satisfy him. Perhaps never has. He finds freedom in solitude, in isolation. Only in silence can he hear the music he is trying to find, with and without his hands, without incongruous tunes derailing him. It is Mother Mary who stands between the crossroads. One wolf goes left, the other goes right. We do not know which road leads to perdition or to light. Mother Mary watches without judgment, her porcelain face impassive, and does not tell us. Whichever road is taken, her mercy will always follow. With caustic submersion, an almost clinical acuity, and an intimacy that harrows, The Banshees of Inisherin is a stark capsule of human nature, man's sacrifice for sovereignty and the need for reconciliation. Like Colum, we are left mutilated by the end as we witness the futility of judgment in the face of God's indifference. Finding meaning in the casual cruelty of life gives us no option but to laugh or cry, and we are left gutted as we contemplate the price of revelation.
Do you think God gives a damn about miniature donkeys, Colum? I fear he doesn't, and I fear that's where it's all gone wrong.
Colum's revelation is one that man is designed for more. He wakes up one day with the fear that he is staving off the inevitable toll of death. He believes his best friend, Porik's dull personality, contributes to the stagnancy that makes his life insignificant. Colum wants to spend his remaining years composing music, creating something he is proud of and leaving a legacy. He's tired of wasting his life dabbling in the nonsense of others, instead seeking peace and stillness of mind. He exerts his right to silence, which Porik cannot accept, even when faced with the grotesque consequences of his ignorance. Colum warns Porik that for each time he bothers him, he will cut off one of his fingers. The self-mutilation of Colum and the austerity in which he performs it is not unlike the martyred saints immolating for their faith. His silence and his peace belongs to him, and nobody can violate it. In return, he cuts off a finger, an eye for an eye. There's a strange sort of logic in his brand of insanity. It is his sanctified right to be left alone, yet nobody around him listens or cannot understand. On the other hand, Porrick represents the nice, simple man of good soil. He believes he is the kindest of the bunch until his adequacy is challenged. And it is not untrue. Porrick's virtuous qualities are self-evident. He starts off unquestionably kind, well-meaning, and good-natured. He gets along more with animals than he does with people, and is otherwise easily satisfied, until Colum's sudden metamorphosis unravels him. He begins to question everything, himself, his life, the world, his place in it. He cannot rest until he has answers, and he cannot respect Colum's explicitly stated boundaries. He first enters Colum's house politely, then with each time grows increasingly more violent. Eventually he just kicks the door down, and finally he burns it. Porrick's scenes are often intercut with shots of animals' faces. Horses, cows, donkeys. He is a mirror of their quaint, undisturbed, and yet base, primitive nature. When he lashes out in jealousy by telling Colum's new friend that his father is dying so that he will leave Inisherin, he cannot see the cruelty in the act and feels no remorse. Ironically, it is Dominic, the dim and disturbed boy, who can see Porrick clearly. You are no different to them. As Porrick's buried fear of meaninglessness is unearthed out of his loneliness, a photo-negative to Colum's same fear, his unwinding sense of self continues to undermine him. In that scene, Porrick and Dominic sit on a ledge looking out across the expansiveness of the sea, the sky, and the country. But Porrick has no connection to that part of life, symbolic of where his development actually lies. He speaks of his cruel action like a joke. He doesn't know what it does to another human being and has no concept that it was an unkind thing to do, while he claims himself to be kind. He might have been genuinely kind before, but that got mutilated as well by the loss of connection to his friend, or the loss of connection to himself. To me, Dominic is the innocence of humanity, mangled and beaten by the harsh, cruel, and coarse world. But despite that unfairness that has been done to him, he still manages to keep a kind and hopeful heart. But when Porrick proves that he has strayed from his goodness, Dominic feels betrayed and frightened. His father, a degenerate, cruel policeman, symbolizes the violent unfeelingness of man's worst incarnation. The enforcer of the law while simultaneously the bastardization of man's most sacred law. And this theme of mockery is prevalent in the film. Religion is perfunctory and barely realized to the point of sacrilege as the priest embodies the exact opposite of its real tenets. As we find out that Dominic's father killed his mother, we see that Dominic seeks the feminine touch, the grace, and the unconditional love of the mother. And he seeks it in Siobhan, Porrick's sister, who seems to embody those virtues. His desire to merge with Siobhan, or to one day earn her love, or the light of the Mother Mary, is his only hope and will to live. So when he is rejected by Siobhan, that dream is over. There is no hope left for him, and no more goodness on earth. And it has been snuffed out of existence, and there is nothing left to do but die. Siobhan represents a great and necessary force. She is almost the heart of the film. When Colm is waxing about Mozart in the pub and how people still remember his work from the 17th century, Siobhan says one thing. It was the 18th century, not the 17th. Siobhan is an educated, talented, beautiful woman. She is wasting her talent and existence stuck on the island, but she evidently stays for her brother. The woman in the shop is always hungry for gossip, yet Siobhan refuses to tell her anything. She is sick and tired of the mundanity, if she's being honest with herself, just like Colm is, and she's actually the only one who seems to understand him. Doesn't condone his actions, but understands him. And when the policeman tells her, "No wonder nobody likes you," it's like a slap in her face, an attack on the part of her that is still fragile. She cries herself to sleep and can't even express her sadness. Siobhan is the only one who successfully gets off the island. And on the other side of the river, the old crone waves at her, symbolizing death, while on the other side, Siobhan represents new life. At the end of the day, you either run into yourself or out of yourself, for everywhere you turn, you can't escape your hunger. One of the greatest polarities between Colm and Porrick is their idea of what makes life meaningful. To Porrick, it is being a nice person, and to Colm, it is being remembered, stating that no one in history was ever remembered for being quote-unquote nice. In this scene, we are able to understand both of their views. Porrick, incensed, argues that he remembers his parents and sister for being nice, while Colm answers that no one else will ever remember them. Colm wants to have something to show for all his years, whereas for Porrick, being decent in the present is enough for a life well lived. And while both sides of the story are understandable, they are incomplete. For the greatness and niceness they each describe cannot exist without the other. If one spent all their life striving for artistic greatness, yet nobody had any memory of niceness or even the concept of being nice, then art and music could not be enjoyed, because the faculty to feel and understand art is highly connected to the simple joys and mundane decencies of common folk. Yet, if everyone only strived to be nice, then of course nothing would ever be accomplished.
What do you want out of him? Silence.
Among the idyllic and insulated dreamscape, the silence of the film stretches over you like a thin, prickly blanket, pervading every corner of your mind. The haunting, stripped-back score elevates the moments of revelation, and the recurring bell that chimes in unmerciful moments is reminiscent of both Jenny the Pony's bell, which symbolizes Porrick's heart, and an altar bell. The bell of the church signifies the voice of God, and humans' ears are deaf to it. Set during the Irish Civil War, the staccato cannon fire is vaguely heard across the water and used in the same sparring manner, reminding people that their willful complacency is easily shattered. The same side, fighting each other for peace. On one side of the water, religion against religion, government against government. The other side, in the sparse rural rusticity, not even they can find peace amongst themselves. And the one man who seeks peace cannot even have it. In the climax of the film, Colm finally severs the remaining four of his fingers and hurls them at Porrick's door after he once again trespassed his silence. This event causes Porrick's beloved pony, Jenny, to choke on one of the fingers accidentally and die. This is the pivotal event of the film, where Porrick completes his becoming. When Jenny dies, his heart dies. And just like Jenny, Porrick could not swallow Colm's rejection of mundanity. Even when his sister Siobhan offers him a chance of starting a new life, he rejects it. He would rather stay an animal and pursue vengeance, for it makes no difference to him. He is dead already. The absurdity and futility of the situation is that Porrick will not find peace until Colm pays with his life. After Jenny dies, Porrick states to Colm that he, on 2 o'clock on Sunday, God's resting day, he is going to commit the greatest crime against humanity. Burn down his house with Colm in it. Colm does not react, just as he does not react when Porrick sets fire to his house with him in it. He sees it as fair, an eye for an eye. At that moment of threat, the policeman barges into the pub, and Colm knocks him out with one punch for his interference. Strangely enough, Colm didn't want the policeman to interfere because he saw something pure in what Porrick was going to do. In that moment, he sees justice being presented through Porrick that he had not seen elsewhere. There is a purity, even, in the expression of natural justice. While on the contrary, the cop does not represent natural justice at all, but a contaminant of it. Good people can do horrible, destructive things to another good person, for evil is in all of us, all along. When a man's heart dies, his mind takes over and becomes violent out of desperation. And at the end, when he lets all his animals live in a house with him, for before Siobhan would not let them inside, one accidentally knocks over the little bell sitting next to him that used to hang on Jenny's collar. He very gently picks it up and sets it upright. For Jenny was his spirit, and when she died, vengeance came. But there is still a part of Porrick that covets and protects it. There is still a part of him that is, and perhaps always will be, left totally untouched.
Some things there's no moving on from, and I think that's a good thing.
By this final line, we have come to accept that, no matter the path human beings take, we will all end up in the same place. God takes no winners or losers, there is no judgment, for each side has its place. Mother Mary stands remote in the middle of the crossroads and blesses either path. Porrick may waste his life on revenge, yet he will ultimately be forgiven. Even after he has burned down Colm's house and all his belongings, attempting to take his life, Colm still thanks him for looking after his dog, to which Porrick says, "Any time." In the same way that Jenny was Porrick's heart, Colm's dog is his. And it is the only thing Porrick could not bear to destroy in the burnt wreckage. Finally, as Colm stands alone on the beach, watching the wild emptiness of the sea, he is free. He has no house, no belongings, no fingers to play his instrument and make his music. Yet he holds no resentment, no animosity. He has stripped himself of attachment, possessions, and fear. He has traded in the external satisfaction of the flesh for the eternal music of the silence. Fingerless, he cannot play the fiddle again, but alone on the beach he hums the same tune. Much like Van Gogh and his severed ear, the pain does not matter to him. It's not even real, for he no longer lives there. He is in the painting which is immortal, or in Colm's case, he is in the music which is everywhere. He gave his fingers to Porrick because that was what Porrick related to. Colm no longer needed them as much as he needed his peace or his freedom. In a lasting shot, Porrick walks away from Colm along the pale stretch of beach. But between the two men in the distance is the haunting figure of the old crone who kept appearing ominously throughout the film. Everybody avoids and hides from her, and the more they try to dodge her, the more she shows up, unsettling and irreverent. The thing is, a part of them knows that she resembles fate and shadow. They are afraid of her as they are afraid of the inevitability of time catching up with them, as much as they are afraid of their own screaming image in the dark, the aching loneliness and the crushing uncertainty in their caged-in life. They are the banshees of Innisharan. The crone lingers in the frame, a black pillar between estranged friends, symbolizing the endless cycle they have both set themselves on and the gaping gulf between them. And yet, the redemption and perhaps intrinsic tethering they have already achieved, whether they like it or not, and will always return to. The positioning of the crone in the frame is purposeful. Her perspective is the exact same as the Mother Mary's statue between the crossroads. She is stood at a remote distance in the center as two men walk opposite ways. What does this mean for us? That fate and mercy are entwined, and just two sides of the same coin. The final shot of the film is a great flaming sunset over the remote, cold hills of Inisherin. And even in such a damp listlessness, there is life and beauty. When everyone has left and all has been lost, the world still sparkles and burns its torrential glory. But the recoiling question of this film remains. Why does Colm cut off his fingers? Think about it. If playing music is so important to him, why does he eliminate the only way he could possibly achieve it? What drives a man to make such a drastic decision? It's not just insanity, because otherwise what's the point of making this movie, right? So, Colm, like everyone else on the island, is a religious man. He goes to church every Sunday, recites his psalms, confesses his sins. He hangs crosses right outside his window. But in the half-hearted obligations of religion, what meaning does it possibly have beyond the insula? What is the institution of religion, truly, if not another constraint on your heart? Like the rustic bricks of their houses and the cold mercilessness of the water that surrounds them, it is another cage we have all willingly fell into. Colm is questioning the meaning in every aspect of his life, including this. The priest tells him that self-mutilation is the greatest sin, for you are maiming the work of God. Colm, vaguely surprised, says, "Then I'm pretty much fucked, aren't I?" When he is told that it is a sin to punch a policeman, he responds, "If it's a sin to punch a policeman, we should all just go home." This is recognizing the fact that we have no right to justice. We are just enslaved by the powers that be. And how can his relationship with God be represented by that? Colm represents a force that is trying to break free from the age-old status quo, beyond man's interpretation of religion. In fact, one could even argue that Colm's self-mutilation is religious to him. Much like Christ's willingness to be nailed to the cross and paraded for all to mock, Colm leaves his fingerless nubs unwrapped, blood trailing behind him, letting the world unabashedly witness the horror, bitter and red like a crow's gut. When Siobhan asks him if it hurt, he shrugs apathetically, saying that it did at first, but not anymore. The nonchalance of which he performs the supposedly greatest sin is indicative of something much more elusive than pride or insanity. Could it be a strange form of piousness that is beyond any of those things known to man? Again, it begs the question, why does he cut off his fingers when he knows he can never play music again? What remains is the fact that music must not be the most important thing to him, after all. But it is an avenue to a destination, the same way mutilation arrives him at the same destination. Something worth more than the pain. It is not that it doesn't hurt or that the sacrifice of his fingers don't matter to him, and of course it matters. The fact that it matters is what makes it easier for him to execute. It is not so much a divorce of the flesh than it is a marriage of the flesh and the soul, and perhaps the divorce of another false part. Colm even seems happier when mutilated, unable to play music, than he is when he could play. So we must get something out of that choice that he didn't in playing music, something equally important or satisfying to him. So it is not music, but what music brings to him. In the face of the world's falsity, his choice of mutilation and gruesome display of his bloody flesh is his only real connection to God. When the church's institution of what is right and wrong no longer holds up, and despite the fact that it is seen as an act of rebellion or sin, on the contrary, Colm is still a man of God. He's not divorcing religion, but finding sacrament in himself, in his own flesh and blood. Symbolically reminiscent of Christ's surrender of his body, Colum is willing to display his mangled sin without remorse or emotion as a cadaver for all humanity to witness. It is the equal consecration and desecration of man's belief in God. Therefore, whatever he has sacrificed his fingers for has to be greater than everything. His fingers are his means to work and do and act. He is sacrificing his ability to do for his ability to be. Whatever he is trying to do does not need his fingers to get there, or it cannot even be achieved with his fingers. And instead of one player in a symphony, he is now the conductor waving his fiddle in the air with a bloody fist. His soul's freedom, then, is the price worth his physical deformity. Perhaps it can't even be compared in importance, and that is why Colum is so unaffected by his gruesome actions. The arabesque in the grotesque. Another interesting way to see it is that his five fingers may represent the five houses of ego. Name, possessions, career, community, and belief. By cutting off each one, he is relinquishing each aspect of ego. Five false realities, like the outlandish masks hanging in his house. At the end of the film, all his masks are burned as he has become truly free and honest with himself. That freedom is so much more important to him than pain. It is the only thing that is real to him. He is happy for others to bear witness to his transformation by revealing it in public, because there's nothing to hide. The fact that Jenny choked and died on one of his fingers shows how the spirit is killed by the ego. All throughout the film, the iconography of religion haunts. When a grievous act is committed, it is followed or lingered with the cross or Mother Mary. Respectively, the symbols of sacrifice and savagery, grace and mercy, these shots are indicative of man's complex nature. What path will they take? Savagery or grace? And what is savagery in the vast wilderness of mortality? Is it not graceful in its contradictions, in its atonement of living? Is there not savagery in grace, and grace in savagery? As Cain forsook Abel, so do our two wolves abandon. The only measure of peace is found when they are reconciled as one. But in the end, the shadow passes. Like the old crone who haunts the aisles and people avoid, God does not interfere and watches impassively as he experiences himself through us. We either sink or swim, recreate or destroy ourselves and each other. Either way, the universe is indifferent. All parts of us are being experienced in whichever way is available, and that is a good thing. This marks the end of the episode. Thank you for listening, for tuning in. I hope you will go and see this great film if you haven't already. And if you have, I hope that this gave you an alternative perspective, because everyone has completely different perspectives. And actually, I'd like to hear what people's other perspectives are, because obviously, this is very like specific. And I'm sure the actual writer, Martin McDonagh, didn't even like intend any of what I just said. Like, this is me reading into it a lot. And I'm sure he was just really in the flow when he made this film and wasn't like analytically thinking of all of this symbolism. But that's one of the reasons why I think it worked so well, because it was not like intentional that way. But yeah, I know a lot of people have different takes on what the movie is actually about. And yeah, I'd love a discussion about it. Anyway, I hope you enjoyed this episode. This is Grace Curley from To See or Not to See. What did you see or not see? That is the question.